Okay, so are you ready to go on a little adventure with me today?
Always up for an adventure.
All right, excellent. The Church of Tinkerbell podcast.
Faith, imagination, the power of belief.
Love and acceptance to make the world a better place.
What would happen if we all just tried to see the world through the eyes of a child again, even for a moment?
It's a beautiful thought, isn't it?
It is.
The Church of Tinkerbell.
The Church of Tinkerbell. All right, I'm intrigued. We're taking on a really important topic. We're diving into biology, human rights, and the idea of bodily autonomy.
Yeah, and our source material for this deep dive comes from, well, it's compiled from the Church of Tinkerbell.
Right, which listeners might know for their focus on radical kindness, asking big questions, maybe a bit of whimsy too, challenging norms.
Exactly. And our goal here, our mission, is pretty clear. We want to really understand what intersex means.
Okay.
Look at the challenges, historically and now, especially around medical treatment. And also, importantly, highlight the progress being made.
Progress in, like, laws and medical standards.
Yes, precisely. Globally, even.
And we're framing this around Intersex Awareness Week, is that right?
That's the timing. Wow. It runs from Intersex Awareness Day on October 26th right through to November 8th, which is Intersex Day of Remembrance and Solidarity. It's a key window for, you know, education and action.
Got it. All right, let's start with the basics then, the definition. Our sources stress being precise here. So when we say intersex, what exactly are we talking about?
Right. So intersex is basically an umbrella term. It's for people born with innate variations in their sex characteristics.
Innate meaning from birth.
Yes, from birth. And these variations could be in chromosomes, hormones, internal anatomy, maybe external genitalia.
So anything that doesn't neatly fit the typical medical boxes for male or female?
Exactly. You might sometimes hear the term VSD, variations of sex development, used clinically too. Same idea.
Okay, so physical biological traits present at birth. And the sources really emphasize what it's not, which feels just as important to clarify.
Absolutely crucial. Intersex is a natural human variation. It happens. It's existed across cultures throughout time.
And it's definitely not about who someone is attracted to.
Correct. It's not a sexual orientation, and it's also not the same thing as gender identity.
So an intersex person could identify as a man, a woman, non-binary.
Anything else. Just like anyone. Their identity is their own.
And thinking about that radical kindness lens from the source, language matters hugely here. They specifically call out the word hermaphrodite.
Oh, yeah. That word is outdated. It's stigmatizing medical jargon, really. We should avoid it.
So the preferred terms are
intersex person or person with an intersex variation. Simple, respectful.
Makes sense. Now, what about how common this is? People often ask about the numbers.
Right, and this is where it gets interesting because the estimates you see can vary quite a bit.
Why is that? Is it about how you define it or just bad data?
It's mostly about the definition. Depends on exactly which variations get included in the count. If you take a really narrow medical view, the number looks smaller.
But if you include all conditions that lead to these kinds of variations,
then the responsible range, the one we should probably use, is somewhere between, say, 0.3% and 1.7% of the population.
Okay, hold on. 1.7%. That upper end. That feels surprisingly common.
It does, doesn't it? And the source material gives a fantastic comparison to help grasp that.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
That 1.7% figure. It's roughly comparable to the percentage of people born with red hair.
Wow. Okay. Red hair. That really changes things. Yeah. I think most people, myself included, assume it's much, much rarer. That comparison clicks.
It does. Puts the diversity into perspective.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit. Let's talk history. Because the fight for autonomy, it has a specific starting point, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
Intersex Awareness Day itself, October 26th, commemorates a protest back in 1996.
What happened then?
A group of activists demonstrated outside the American Academy of Pediatrics conference in Boston. They were there to publicly challenge something specific.
Which was?
The common medical practice at the time of performing non-consensual surgeries on intersex infants and children. Surgeries meant to normalize their bodies.
And decades later, this exact issue, non-consensual surgery on kids, is still the main focus.
It absolutely is. That's the core struggle today. Fighting against medically unnecessary surgeries performed on children without their consent.
And the key there is medically unnecessary, right? We're not talking about life-saving procedures.
Precisely. The sources are clear. These surgeries are very often not about urgent medical need. They're usually done to make the child's body look more typically male or female.
Driven by what? Social anxiety, fear of stigma.
Pretty much. Social pressure, parental anxiety, sometimes outdated medical beliefs, not immediate health needs.
And these surgeries, performed so early, they can cause lasting harm.
Immense harm, yeah. The sources detail irreversible physical and psychological damage.
Like?
Loss of sexual sensation, chronic pain, scarring, infertility, and, you know, deep psychological trauma, especially when the person finds out later what was done without their knowledge or consent.
So it's done in infancy or childhood, often justified by this idea that the adults are preventing future suffering by making the child fit in.
Right, that was the old thinking. But it came at the cost of the individual's future choice and bodily integrity.
There used to be this medical argument, or maybe myth, that doing the surgery early was necessary for the child's psychological well-being for a normal life. What does the evidence actually say now?
The evidence just doesn't support that anymore. Decades of research and listening to intersex adults has shown that early cosmetic surgeries do not reliably lead to better psychosocial outcomes.
So the opposite might even be true.
But what is clear is that deferring any non-urgent procedures is now recognized as the approach that respects human rights. It respects bodily autonomy.
It lets the person decide for themselves when they're old enough.
Exactly. Informed choice, that's the standard.
And we are seeing some shifts, even if slow. You mentioned a specific hospital in the U.S.
Yes, Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. In 2020, they took a really significant step.
What did they do?
They publicly apologized for past practices involving these kinds of surgeries and, crucially, committed to stopping cosmetic normalizing surgeries on intersex children.
Wow. An apology and a policy change. That feels like a big deal.
It is a big deal. It's a powerful moral signal. And it reflects that shift towards deferral becoming the standard of ethical care. Whether it has legal teeth everywhere is another question, but culturally, it's significant.
Okay, so that's a key development locally. But this isn't just a U.S. issue. The sources highlight global movement too, right? On a policy level.
Oh, absolutely. The momentum is international. There have been major steps forward recently, especially in international frameworks.
Like what?
Well, maybe the biggest was in April 2024. The UN Human Rights Council adopted its very first resolution specifically on the rights of intersex people.
First ever. That sounds like a landmark.
It really is. The resolution urges all member states to end discrimination and these harmful medical practices. It provides a strong global foundation for advocacy.
So the UN sets a standard. Are individual countries actually putting laws in place?
Yes, several have. Malta was the trailblazer here.
Malta? When was that?
Back in 2015. They passed the world's first law specifically protecting intersex children from non-consensual medical interventions. A real pioneer.
Okay, who followed?
Germany came next in 2021. They adopted a national law restricting surgeries on minors with variations of sex development unless the minor consents or under very specific circumstances.
And Greece, too.
Greece in 2022. They prohibited medical interventions aimed at changing an intersex minor sex characteristics if they're under 15, unless the minor gives their own informed consent.
So we're seeing real legal protections emerge in different places. Protecting the body is key. But the sources also talked about dignity in other ways, like paperwork.
Yeah, reducing bureaucratic harm. It's part of that radical kindness approach applied to systems.
How so?
Take Germany's 2024 self-determination law. It wasn't just about intersex people, but it helps them, along with trans and non-binary folks, by making it much simpler to update their legal name and gender marker on official documents.
Ah, so less hassle, less need to justify your existence to the state.
Exactly. It makes navigating life easier and upholds dignity. Less stress, less potential for harm from the system itself.
These laws are the framework. But to really understand the impact, we need to hear about lived experiences. The sources included some stories, right? Well, let's talk about Ava.
Right. Ava's story, it's a composite based on common experiences. She's 27. It really starkly illustrates the failure of that old model, the lack of consent.
What happened to her?
She underwent non-urgent surgery as an infant. The goal was purely social conformity. The idea was it would make her life easier down the road.
But it didn't work out that way.
No. As an adult, she experienced chronic nerve pain, reduced sensation, and just a lot of confusion about her body and her history.
And how did she find out the truth? This part was striking.
She only learned the full story about her intersex variation and the surgery when she was 22. And she found out by accessing her old medical records herself.
Wow. Not from her parents, not from doctors directly telling her as she grew up.
Apparently not in her case, which led to, you know, immense grief, anger, but also interestingly, relief.
Relief? How so?
Relief that she wasn't somehow broken or flawed. She understood that adults had made a choice about her body, a choice that really should have been hers.
Her story really brings home that ethical question the sources raise. What does first do no harm actually mean here?
Exactly. If the harm you think you're preventing is potential social stigma, but the treatment involves irreversible physical changes without consent, where's the actual harm reduction?
The source material seems to strongly suggest that true do no harm means waiting, prioritizing future consent.
Absolutely. It means prioritizing the individual's right to choose their autonomy over immediate cosmetic conformity or easing adult anxieties. The focus has to be on the person's future.
Okay, then there's the second story, Jonah. He's 16. His experience sounds quite different, more aligned with this newer rights-based approach.
Yes, Jonah's story shows the power of agency when the system works better. He was diagnosed at 14.
How?
Through blood work, after puberty wasn't progressing as typically expected. Initially, he got some rushed info from an older doctor, which wasn't great.
But his family sought better care.
They did. They found clinicians who practiced rights-based care. Jonah was given clear information, real options, and crucially, he got to choose.
And what did he choose?
He chose watchful waiting. Basically, monitoring his health, but no immediate interventions. His bodily autonomy was respected right from the start.
That's huge. And he also did something really interesting in his school environment about language.
Yeah, this part is brilliant. He advocated for a small but powerful change in his biology class.
What was it?
He asked the teacher to stop using absolutes like girls always have XX chromosomes. Instead, he suggested using the word typically.
Ah. Girls typically have XX chromosomes. Simple, but it changes everything.
Totally. It makes space for diversity. It acknowledges variation without making it sound like an error or an exception to a rigid rule.
It's a fantastic example of that radical kindness applied practically. It prompts us to think, doesn't it? Where else could we use typically?
Right. In our workplaces, on forms, in healthcare settings, in how we talk about bodies generally, where could replacing absolutes with typically make things more accurate, more inclusive, more dignified?
It seems like such a small change, but the impact could be massive. Okay, this leads us nicely into actionable steps for listeners thinking, okay, I get it, what can I do? The sources had a try this week list.
Yep, some concrete things. First one, share one resource created or led by intersex people themselves. Amplify their voices. Get information directly from the community.
Good one. What else?
Second, look at any forms you use or have influence over. Intake forms, HR documents, whatever. Ask, is that sex MF field actually necessary? If it is, can you add an X or another option, or even prefer not to say?
Reducing that bureaucratic burden again, making systems kinder.
Exactly. And third, if you're in any kind of teaching or learning role, formal or informal, try adding just one sentence to relevant discussions. Biology is diverse and some people are intersex.
Normalizing it, making it visible.
Just stating it as a fact of human diversity.
Okay, so those are practical steps. Stepping back, what's the bigger picture here? The so what of Intersex Awareness Week?
Well, ultimately, it's about ending practices that cause harm. It's about protecting the future choices of children. It's about building systems, medical, legal, social, that ensure everyone gets dignity, truthful information, and genuine choice about their own body.
And even with big steps like the UN resolution,
the work isn't done. Discrimination still happens. Access to affirming, rights-based healthcare is still unequal. So policy change is vital, but we also need that deeper cultural transformation, making sure these rights are actually real in people's lives.
Right. So to recap, we've defined intersex as innate variations in sex characteristics. We know it's more common than many think, maybe up to 1.7% like red hair.
We stress that the core fight is for bodily autonomy, particularly deferring non-urgent surgeries on children until they can consent.
And we've seen real progress internationally with the UN resolution and laws in places like Malta, Germany, and Greece.
And heard how lived experiences, like Ava's and Jonah's, highlight the difference between the old model and a rights-based future.
Okay, so for our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to take away, building on Ava's story and that history of medical secrecy.
Yeah, here's something to chew on. If the default in the past for doctors and sometimes families was non-disclosure, was secrecy, what specific things do we need to build now?
Build where?
In our medical systems, definitely, but also in schools. and how families talk about bodies and differences. What structures do we need to intentionally create to guarantee full transparency?
Transparency and truth.
Truth and real choice. For every single child, no matter what biological variation they happen to be born with, how do we ensure that becomes the new default?
That's a powerful question. Definitely something that requires intentional action, not just passive awareness.
Thanks for going on this little adventure with me today.
Anytime.
And listener, keep sprinkling that fairy dust, all right? We'll see you next time.